this is not about how much can you gain. I'm much more concerned about preservation of capital rather than large upside. It only takes one loss before you're like, all right. So I sold my company in 2023. From there, I got pretty involved into passive investing. I was only buying property for myself, and I found a lot of fun and enjoyment really in getting involved in these passive deals. I'll tell you, trust was the most difficult thing. When you do it all yourself, especially when you're running a small business, you're used to the control. And I had a hard time giving that up. So I went to the person that I had seen in the industry for quite some time. And I felt this person's going to be the right person to park money with. Since then, my criteria has evolved.
Ian Noble joining us from Austin, Texas on Real Estate Development Land to Legacy. Ian, pleasure having you here.
Thanks, Eugene. Happy to be here.
Awesome. We talk a lot about real estate. We talk about development. We talk about investing, finances. Ian has an interesting background, and he is here to share his story, experiences. Why don't you give us a quick overview about how you got here, you know, what made you be interested in real estate?
Sure. I grew up watching my dad do it. So he was a small business owner, but he also had commercial real estate. And I saw that it allowed a lot of opportunity to where he didn't need to be at work. Fast forward many years, that helped me and I think shaped what I thought I could set up for myself. So you mentioned I had a business that I had gotten into or exited from. It was a family business, dry cleaning company. That was the last 13 years of my life. Ran it for a couple of years and then bought it from him in 2016. But from 2014 on, I was buying in Austin rental properties. I would try to do one per year. Started with residential, then migrated to some smaller commercial properties, then experimented with short-term rentals, tried some land. And along the way, I just realized that I love anything that the overlap between small business or entrepreneurship and real estate was really where I wanted to play. So I sold my company in 2023. From there, I got pretty involved into passive investing. Honestly, I didn't know much about it prior to selling the business. It was the world I was focused on was running the day-to-day operations and making sure that everything went well there. I was only buying property for myself, and I found a lot of fun and enjoyment really in getting involved in these passive deals and working with others that have better teams, better systems, and have more access to the kinds of properties that I want to be in. So that's how it all started. And since then, it's just been an evolving journey of learning, meeting new people, partnering, and getting some deals done.
So it's an interesting disconnect that I've observed in the past is that people who are too busy running a business or too busy doing their thing, whatever their thing is, whether they're an engineer or a doctor or whatever, they tend to not really appreciate the fact that there are other businesses who have these well-designed, scaled operations where you can invest and let them manage it for you. I think at least the people that I've spoken to, they are well familiar with buying stocks or buying a fund and investing in, you know, that type of an asset. But how did you decide that being a passive investor in somebody else's syndication is something that you could trust?
I'll tell you, trust was the most difficult thing. When you do it all yourself, especially when you're running a small business, you're used to the control. And I had a hard time giving that up the first time I got involved. And so I went to the person that I had seen in the industry for quite some time. And I felt there was a level of trust that, okay, this person's going to be the right person to park money with. Since then, my criteria has evolved. It's much more stringent in who I partner with. You know, from being in this industry, there could be a great deal in front of you, but if the partner is mediocre or subpar, that deal's not going to make it. So a lot of what I look for now first before the numbers is trying to figure out, is that person someone that I want to do business with and partner with? Because even when you're a passive investor, you have to look at it through the lens of being a long-term partnership. I know you're not running the day-to-day, but you're going to be communicating with this person for years to come. So that's the first check that I'll look at now. And then obviously the numbers are crucial and you have to know them for every single deal. But again, I've put a much stronger emphasis on the people aspect of it first. And then, okay, once they pass the character test, let's dive into your numbers and see how things look.
So how do you, what is that character test? Like, is, do you have like a checklist or is it just a gut feel?
The gut feeling is always there. I tell people to honor your gut feeling because if there's, number one, there's a lot of people in the industry that are either operating deals or raising money for deals. And for that reason, if there is anything in your gut with an individual that you think maybe this isn't the right place to be, just not worth your time. You need to find someone that you feel confident in, that you like, that you think you're going to be in good partnership with. Again, that test, what it looks like, I look at it from two different lenses. I now raise capital. So for the deals that I raise, and especially with new partnerships, I'm generally talking to them several times. I'm not going to invest with them on the first day. It takes a little bit. And I want to know over time, is this person going to put in the effort and time as well? It's a two-way street because there are a lot of operators out there that act like the urgency is there. You got to do it now. This is a sweet deal and it's going away. And I'll say perhaps they're right for whatever they're looking at, but it's just not the style that I operate with. So I move at a little bit slower speed. But once I find that person that passes these tests of, the genuine character, they're not trying to BS me, I don't feel that these values are inflated, that's when you can really break down your barrier and say, all right, now tell me what the product is and tell me how you operate your business. So as a personal investor, there's one set of criteria. And then if we're ever in a situation where we're raising money for that individual, it's much more intense. Background checks, flying to the asset, really, really ripping apart the underwriting, you know, poking holes in everything that we can to make sure that it is what it appears it is.
Right. So it's an interesting story where you started investing as a passive investor and you had to develop the trust with the people that would take your money. But now the tables have turned and you're the person talking to strangers, asking them for money.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, how do you, knowing that you understand that these people need to trust you, need to like you, how do you get them to trust you? How do you get them to like you?
I think relationships take time. And my goal is that once I can talk to somebody and explain who I am and what I've done, you just hope that there's genuine trust that they'll allow you to build. And I think people can see whether or not someone's authentic or not. So for me, I've realized quickly in raising capital that I'm not a good salesman. I've probably missed some opportunities because I'm not the guy that's going to have a polished execution strategy of when I'm going to follow up. How am I going to press this to make it feel like it's very urgent? I'm an investor too. And that's the way I look at my deals as a personal investor. What would I want to hear? And I always view my actions as a business through the lens of that. So relationships do take time. This isn't like somebody clicking a button and buying a stock. There is a business that's being run behind this. There is a certain group of people that have the appetite to invest in real estate. And I always put myself first because when I invest into a deal, especially if other people, we're going to bring that to my network so that we can co-invest together, I'm the first investor in it. So I have to like it all first. And for that reason, I think the interests are aligned and it makes it much easier to talk to people about something that, A, I truly believe in. I'm happy to tell my friends and family about this. This is not some sort of commission grab or finding money through acquisition fees. This is something I'm putting my own money into and I truly believe that it's going to work. I think knowing and leading with that, hopefully people can pick up on your character and intent. And then if it's not for them or you're not for them, then so be it. You know, at least you got to talk real estate and have a good conversation.
Right. I mean, I'm hearing from several investment coaches or raising capital coaches about these programs and techniques where they have these endless webinars and meetings and they are selling their investment opportunities to groups of people at the same time. But personally, I'm like you, I can't imagine having a group of people in a blind webinar without real interaction to listen to you for an hour, maybe even listen to you for an hour twice, and then write a check for hundreds of thousands of dollars. Maybe it exists. I personally have never seen that before.
Me neither.
What? Okay.
there, I'm sure there are people out there that do that, but the majority of our investors, you know, it does take time. They join a mailing list, and then when they're in it, they can kind of see what do the emails look like, what do some of the deals look like, and then again, I don't think that there's people that you've never talked to before that are writing a check, and there shouldn't be. The sponsor or the capital raiser shouldn't allow it either. I know it's great to get money. You know, you're trying. The goal is to raise so you guys can acquire this property. But the guy that got me into this business, when I first met with him, he said, I know my investor's spouse's name. I know their children's name. This is a very personal business. And I like that. I was drawn to it because I'm born and raised in Texas. Southern hospitality is a thing. We move at slower speeds. And I like finding genuine people to work with. Most of our business now, as I'm growing this business, is through referrals. It's finding somebody that already has passed the test of knowing and liking and trusting you. And then they tell their friends, because people in this position, those that have the ability to get involved in these style of investments, generally money is something that they're comfortable talking to their peers about, or they have a group of peers that they'll speak with about this stuff. So it's not this taboo private side of their life. If they're involved in passive real estate deals, they want to share with their friends, because it's a great opportunity for people to be in real estate without having to do the day to day. Because, you know, Eugene, you're on the active side. You guys are very, you know, driven and moving and putting all the pieces together for your business to help clients. But for the passive investor, you know, they are paying to take the back seat and to share profits, because real estate's a full-time job and they may have the money, but not the time. Or they don't have the interest. So I think that it's great. And the more I've been involved in this business, the more I'm enjoying putting people in these positions to where they may not have been real estate people before, but they understand the concept and the benefits of, you know, the tax component, the upside, the cash flow. It's just a whole different set of, I guess, investing principles that you may not get in the stock market or any other investment for that reason.
Right, exactly. Well, and I have been talking about the fact that real estate development, as an example, I grew up in a construction family. So my mindset has been focused on the delivery, on execution, how to get that building from nothing to something. And we've been so focused on how do we actually build it that we often forget that we need to start marketing the business or marketing the building way in advance, maybe even before we start construction, so that by the time it's done, the market is ready, the demand is there. And it's the same thing with raising capital. If you start talking to investors when you need the money, you are already too late. The relationships, as we discussed, take so long to develop that by the time you actually need people to write a check, you better make sure that they know who you are and what you've been working on for the last however long, maybe even last couple of years, so that when that ask comes, they are already familiar with it. It's not that they need to learn about it from the beginning.
You bring up a good point too, that it takes a lot of time in between deals. You don't just want to be that person that emails or texts your friends or colleagues when they're, hey, do you have $50,000? We have this great opportunity. You know, it doesn't work that way. And so I think the hardest part about this business in general is the, you know, the continuous touch points throughout the way and letting people know who you are, how you operate, what's going on. Even if they don't care to read it, it's the intent of making sure that people know you're working every day, day in and day out, to provide a service that's helpful to them. And to your point, you may have, if you're raising money last minute or you haven't put in the time of these relationships, you might get some immediate friends and family. But as you develop into your business, and if you want to go beyond that sphere of influence, then yes, it's going to take a lot more effort and energy and communication with these new investors. Now, how people go about it is their own choice to build their business in that regard. But to your point, you want to bring value along the way and let them know that this is what you do, this is who I am and my identity. Because it was funny, when I first got in this business, Eugene, I thought that it was going to be easy. Honestly, I already liked real estate, and so I didn't have to convince myself. And I said, well, people know I've had real estate for 10 plus years. I actively manage my own stuff. I've run a successful business. I've sold the business when it was successful, and it didn't translate. You find that there's a big gap between people that have intent or that understand the benefits of it. And for those that don't, it's it's a difficult sell. And it's not my job to sell them on something. At that point, all you can hope is that, you know, you can talk to them and educate them along the way. To your point, these things take time.
Exactly, exactly. Well, let's talk about some asset classes. What do you invest in these days?
The two that I focus on are private lending funds and mobile home parks. So the private lending fund, it offers the liquidity. I call it the parking garage. People either put money in there, myself included, as is a good way to earn a low risk, you know, steady, predictable income from the cash flow perspective. And then we have mobile home parks, and those come up just like you would buy a property. There's a time frame, you get something under contract, then you have a window to raise the funds. That gives the tax benefits of the real estate ownership. I'm true equity owners. There's cash flow, there's upside, and some strategies along the way that we try to help all the investors. So those are the two things that I focus on in my business now, just because I like the mobile home park class. I think from an affordable housing standpoint, it's going to be crucial, especially as there's a gap that continues to spread between wages and the price of homes. So in any market, we'll often compare these to two-bedroom apartments and what that would cost. And knowing that you can provide a solution to that where even allows for home ownership. You know, sometimes these mobile home parks, people don't know that the residents can own the home themselves. And so there's some pride of ownership. People stay there a long time. Another benefit is that the supply is capped, or not capped, but I'll say extremely limited. You're not going to see these things popping up next to, you know, next door to a retail shopping center or on a main corridor. It just doesn't happen anymore. So I like that component of it, that it's semi-protected and you're not seeing a new influx of supply that's hitting the market. So I think for those two reasons, I really enjoy that asset class.
Love it. Let's focus a little bit on the debt fund first, and then I have a million questions about the mobile home parks. So it's interesting. My previous episode was focused on mobile home parks, and before then, I really knew very little about them. But I want to come back to it. Let's talk about the debt fund a little bit. So you mentioned it's a relatively safe, I think you said, means of getting a steady return. Can you explain how that works?
Yeah. So debt funds can be structured in a lot of different ways. Generally, for people listening, think of it like a loan. You're loaning on some sort of product or asset class. So we see it where people loan on like private credit to businesses or on real estate. The one that I focus on is on a portfolio of single family homes. So in short, the investor gets 8%, 9%, or 10%, depending on what's put in. And this is what got me into the business, because I was looking for a safe alternative to a money market account. And if you look at it, U.S. households are sitting on record high money market and checking accounts, just a lot of cash that they're waiting to deploy. The thought would be, okay, if money markets, as of today, they're like 3%, 3.5%, what if you could earn 8%? You know, what's the opportunity cost of that? And so that was attractive to me enough to where getting into the business, I found that it was low enough risk and good enough return to be able to bring people together and talk to them about this. That one in particular, and the one I focus on, is again, portfolio of single family homes. If the investor is getting paid 8%, 9%, or 10%, the borrower is a fix and flipper that is buying a home. We are first lien position. There's a low LTV, the loan to value ratio. So when I say safety, you know, if you're lending at 65% of the value, just for a number's sake, $100,000 home, they're being lent $65,000, but now we are in first lien position if it doesn't perform. So you're not owning the home, but you own the collateral just like the bank would. And when you lend at 13, 14% team, because we have a whole team that runs this, they, you know, that's how we make money. It's the delta between the two. So the cost of capital is what, you know, the investors are putting in. They get 8%, 9%, or 10%, and then we make the difference with the operations of the team. Because again, that's why people choose to be passive, because it's a full-time business. And the team is so good and they work their tail off and they have good character. And that is why I am focused on continuing to grow that business, because I really believe in it.
Do investors get to choose what properties you invest in?
No, it's the whole portfolio. It hovers around 450 homes. But it's all spread out from a risk perspective. I was talking to someone the other day and we were explaining that, you know, $100,000 into the fund, if there's 450 houses, for example's sake, It was like $222 a house. So it's very much spread out and designed. That is theory, right? You're not taking that, dividing it by 450 homes and putting $222 into each home, a large fund where the portfolio, again, is spread amongst everything. But that is how risk is diversified against. So that is how generally it operates. But you're not getting to pick, because I hear people say flipping is risky. And I would agree to a certain, you know, there's a point in you know, maybe your local market or a friend or family member saying, hey, there's a good opportunity. Let's go flip this house. Then I would say, yes, you have a much higher degree of risk. But these are, again, we're not flipping the homes. We are the bank and acting as the bank. And there's an expectation, and our collateral is the home itself. And what's really cool about this, the team that runs it are all ex-flippers. So we've had situations to where, you know, there should have been a default, but the team knows, okay, we're good people. Let's work with them to get this right. Maybe someone's 80% done and they get very ill, you know, or you have some sort of tragedy happen with one of the borrowers. A bank would just say foreclosure, but this team is structured to where we've got a division that can help finish this product so that we don't skip a beat.
Okay. What's been, if you don't mind me asking, feel free to decline if you don't to answer that question. But in the last couple of years, the market's been tough. Real estate hasn't been moving quite as aggressively. I've seen a lot of flippers selling their homes below what it cost them to remodel them. What has been your experience? Has there been an increase in default?
There hasn't been an increase in default. We have, you know, there have been some that have been saved, like I mentioned, that to where perhaps something isn't working at the end. With the portfolio and how the risk is diversified, though, we have a high percentage of return borrowers, and we're in pro growth, strong markets. So this is primarily centered in the Carolinas. You'll have some properties sprinkle into Georgia or, you know, maybe Tennessee, but it's that region that is generally strong growth. At the end of the day, whether, obviously, you're not going to continue to work and lend with fix and flippers that aren't performing. So you're looking for, at least at a minimum, someone who's done a couple of flips. There's a personal guarantee on this. And again, but it's asset-based lending. So at the end of the day, you have to lend on that particular property knowing that if all else fails, you're comfortable with the amount you've given and the value of what that home is. So fortunately for the fund, there is good criteria and measures put in place to be able to prevent from it, you know, going south or having any disruptions. This one, and again, it was in existence before I got involved, has been 5 years in the running. And, you know, at the time of this recording, no missed distributions, you know, zero losses to any investor. It's just slow and steady. And that's why I like it. And again, I'm not saying this, I'm not feel like I'm soliciting the thing now, but it's really, it's more of a personal preference. I'm an investor too. And it, you know,
sure,
everybody, all the founders, everyone has their money in it. And so it's something that they're both passionate about, and because it works and it's a good model, especially with different asset classes that are, you know, there's ups and downs. And over the last couple of years, multifamily's had a tough run, or real estate in general has been the last couple of years, a lot of people questioning or revisiting their strategy. But the lending side has been pretty consistent from what we've seen.
That's great. That's great. There are a lot of private debt funds out there. How do you differentiate yourself? What makes you different? What stands you apart from anybody else, or, you know, maybe some of those multi-billion-dollar funds that exist?
Yeah, I would say it's the product type and what we're investing into. So there are many funds out there that kind of spread. If it's a private credit fund, it may pay a couple percentage points higher, but it's spreading out these loans against all varieties of assets in multifamily or businesses. And I think there's a higher degree of risk for those. A lot of those, you know, if you want to know, where's that money going? Is this rescue capital because that deal is in trouble? We are, from the get-go, identifying something that's not in trouble. And then as such, you know, the team will run it to where, okay, this is a lower risk product. So the two differentiators, I would say, is risk and product. Now, I'll get people, if we're offering 8%, 9%, or 10%, and someone says that's too low, number one, you know, I disagree. I think historically that's a good return, but I'm not here to convince someone whether it's a good deal or not. I'm more focused on risk and preservation of capital. You know, you see it being in the space. There's a lot of deals out there that tell you you're going to make 16, 17% on private credit. And it's like, you might. And if you do, awesome, right? We want you to get that. but that comes with risk, higher return, higher risk. So for me and what I try to present to our investor base, this is not about how much can you gain. I'm much more concerned about preservation of capital rather than large upside. It's more important to me as an investor. And I think that more people are starting to see that it's more important to them as well. It only takes one loss before you're like, all right, I'd rather,
right.
I value stability and safety a little bit more than that juicy return.
Exactly, exactly. I was just going to say, it's up until the time you lose something, that's when you start thinking, oh, well, maybe all those great returns weren't all that exciting because it hurts a lot when you lose.
Yeah. In fact, and a lot of investors too, when they see that, they have their guard up. So it's harder to overcome that obstacle. If they're sophisticated and you see a really high return, it's the next question is, all right, what's the risk? It's got to be somewhat significant. Where I find it to be a lot of fun is educating people that don't know. So nowadays, you know, you'll see a lot of stuff on social media that will tell people what kind of returns they're going to get. And if they don't know better, they don't know better. And that is what I, you know, just caution people to be very careful when they see that. It's not to say there's a lot of really good operators and capital raisers that will do advertising, but just be really, when you look at that deal, make sure that you're going at it from a position of what is the risk and how am I protected here? What's my downside? Much more important than your upside.
Exactly. I mean, when I see, and I've been on the other side of this too, but whenever I see a high return number, it's usually one of three things. It is very risky, or you miss something in your budget, or you're lying to me, which all three of them boil down to it is very risky.
Yes. Yeah. But you know, too, now there are good operators that can produce high returns, but it comes down to the person. And so we talked about that earlier in this show already. It's just all these marketing packages that come up. You got to really be careful. And I talked to someone about this the other day. We had a conference in Austin, and I was able to speak at this conference, and I talked to people about the psychology of investors. And again, I'm probably not the most qualified, but I know enough, right? Like, I work with investors. I'm one myself. And we had this debate on emotion versus logic and how people are making their decisions. So logic seems to be the driver that gets people to look at the deal and approach it seriously. But I believe that the emotional side of it is what gets somebody to actually pull the trigger and invest. And you have all these data people, especially if they're numbers guys and gals, that will say, no, it's all about the numbers. But I disagree. I think it's people first, and because real estate's a people business.
Exactly. Well, and when you're working with a formula, there's multiple variables too. And you could always dial those variables up and down, especially in development. You know, when we talk about high returns or low returns for that matter, a lot of times I get a model and construction cost is, let's say, fixed because that's what your contractors say they can build it for. Maybe you could shop it around, squeeze it by a little bit. Revenue figures are typically fixed based on the current market. If the market improves, great, but the market might decline. So you have to have that cushion. But a lot of times owners, because I work with owners who might have been sitting on that land for a long time, that becomes an interesting variable because what is that land value? And then we start arguing. They tell me, oh, well, this piece of land is worth $10 million. Maybe let's plug your $10 million into the model. If it works, great. It's worth $10 million, maybe more. But in many cases, I see it does not work. And that's when I have to come back and be like, look, all of these variables we've checked, we don't think there's a lot of movement there. We need to adjust your land value variable. And if you put it at zero because you've owned this land or maybe you've inherited it and it's not worth for you, yes, you could potentially artificially inflate the return figure for your investors. And that's your decision. Or you could capitalize on it at the front by squeezing the investor's margin. That's also your decision. But it needs to be that fair, you know, fair balance. So when we talk to owners and we try to figure out what the right model is, because ultimately we need to present it to investors. And if the profit number looks too high, even if you can get there, it still looks unbelievable. And then you're fighting that battle of, did you miss something or are you lying?
Yeah. And you've seen these underwriting models now. If you're trying to present, let's pretend that you want to get a 2x multiple for an investor and the numbers just aren't getting there. Let's say it falls at 185. Well, at that point, and where you need to be careful, to your point, you can kind of gauge what revenue will be. You know, you need to make sure that rent increases are in check, that you're not seeing this wild decrease in expenses that may not be obtainable. But then there are other metrics that can be adjusted, like the cap rate exit or by 0.1. There are these little indicators that can shift the numbers to where you need to be really careful to make sure that is what is being presented in this underwriting model. Is that market? Is it sustainable for their five-year projection? Can they sell at this? You know, the big one, the easy one to look for is the exit rate cap. If they're buying at a 7 cap and on their projections, they're selling at a 5.5 cap, don't do it. You want to level the playing field. And even if they're right, you don't want to underwrite that way. And so these tips have been very helpful to our investors. And sometimes they don't even get that granular in terms of asking these questions, but that's my job to make sure I'm pointing these things out. Often the deal's already been told no before it ever gets to that. I don't want to work with people that are inflating these underwriting models to where even I question it. How's that going to work?
Exactly. Let's spend a few minutes since I promised the listeners that we're going to talk a little bit about mobile home parks. I had an interesting conversation with another guest on a previous episode, so please tune to that as well if you're interested in this asset class. But Ian, could you define for me what the mobile home park is and what flavors are there? I've heard a term RV park, trailer park, mobile home park. There may be more. Are those all synonymous or are they different?
They are, with one of them may not be. So mobile home parks and RV parks often get blended together, but they are different because in mobile home parks, generally, those are long-term. They're more fixed. Yes, that manufactured house might have come in on wheels, but they're very difficult to move. To where a traditional RV, you can hook it up to the back of your pickup truck and off you go. So I would say that that component of it is different. But nowadays, the proper term is manufactured housing communities for these mobile home parks, although I still refer to it as a mobile home park. And you'll hear people say trailer parks. There's all sorts of names that have come up along the way. But is unique about them. I mentioned the supply being protected a little bit earlier, but a lot of people have the perception that's false that these mobile home parks are just run down, dumpy communities. I'm not going to argue. There are some, right? In every asset class, you're going to find dumps. But a lot of the deals in the caliber, what we're looking at is not like that. Nobody's taking on a dump project and trying to make it into a beautiful living community. These are places that already have a rooted community and paved roads. Some of them have basketball courts. You know, these are not what you expect when you think rundown trailer park. And so that's what I like to tell people, that there's this stigma around it. I have family members that have asked me, like, what are you doing in trailer parks? And I thought, no, you're wrong. You haven't seen the really nice ones and you haven't seen the communities that live there. So from an investor standpoint, obviously that's what I focus on. So I really believe in them. But a lot of people need to know there are really nice ones out there. And there's communities in addition to that for like snowbirds or 55 and up crowd that is manicured to where it has palm trees and community centers. You wouldn't expect it when you hear the term mobile home parks, but they're out there and they're nice.
Sorry, my cell phone just rang. I usually turn it off.
Yeah, no worries.
So this is interesting. I've looked at several properties recently where we considered a manufactured home development, and I avoided using the term park because what I learned is that if a manufactured home, which is basically a prefabricated house built at a factory delivered to the job site, if it is sitting on a permanent foundation and it is built to a residential code, building code, then it is just a house. And there are various different finish levels. When it's built and put on a foundation and landscaped around, you would never be able to tell that it was built at a factory. But then there are, the same house could be built to a slightly different code. And if it's still on wheels and it doesn't have a permanent foundation, then it's considered a mobile home. And so what I found is that many municipalities in various zonings and majority of their zonings are explicitly banning manufactured homes that are not sitting on permanent foundation. And I was wondering why, but I'm guessing it's because of that stigma, because it's typically considered as a low-income housing and people are not.
There's a tax benefit is the factor that makes people want them to be on foundations. So from a tax standpoint, and it's dependent upon your state, but for example, in Texas, we have high property taxes. And once your building is on a permanent slab, it becomes real estate property and you're going to be taxed at that. The difference when it's on wheels is that it's still personal property, like a car. And so the states aren't collecting the tax revenue that they would otherwise be if it was a home. So a lot of times you'll see these developments that do have it. And sometimes, you know, they're going to put foundations down, but often you won't see it. And instead, they'll just, you know, these are a couple feet off the ground and they'll put a skirt, or it's called a skirt. They'll put a skirt around it just to close that gap between the ground and the manufactured home. So there are probably other reasons out there, but that's one of them specifically that I can speak to, is that from a revenue standpoint and how they can be taxed, cities aren't collecting as much if they're not on a foundation. That's why tiny homes became very popular too. People could throw them in their backyard, but if you built an ADU and put it on a concrete slab, all of a sudden that's a taxable structure. But if you just roll a tiny trailer back there on wheels and you connect to, you know, whether you connect to your system or you have some sort of independent system to take care of that, people are still earning income from it, but they're not paying the tax on it. So it just depends on the strategy. The negative of that, I'll say, is on a smaller scale, is the upside that, you know, when you're selling something, mobile home parks in itself, those are going to be valued on cap rate and their net operating income. But let's say somebody had one of these in their backyard. There's no upside to having, let's say, a tiny home or something on your property, because yes, it's good for cash flow, but it doesn't enhance the value of your property. It's not on a foundation, and so therefore it can't be counted.
Interesting. Yeah, I didn't know that.
We're between mobile home parks and tiny homes and ADUs in backyards. Yes, it's just talking about, there are lots of options with these manufactured houses. And you've seen them, Eugene. They're nice, the new ones. Sometimes you wouldn't know that it's, if you just saw a photo of the inside, you have no clue that it's a manufactured house.
No, I toured the factory a couple months ago, and it was amazing. Some of them were really pretty low. I don't want to say low quality. The build quality was the same. It's just they had very inexpensive finishes, something that you would see in like low income housing, you know, your like Formica countertops, very simple, inexpensive cabinets, very cheap carpets.
The Home Depot special.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
But then they toured me through one of their upgraded, nicer homes, which was like 20% more expensive, maybe. And it had nice appliances, it had nice quartz countertops, fancier cabinets. I walked through it. I'm like, the bathroom was really nice. The kitchen was really nice. The only thing, I looked at it, the only thing I would have changed is maybe threw out that carpet in bedrooms, and possibly even the LVP that they used in a nicer home was quite a bit nicer, that the little vinyl plank tile. Maybe I would have replaced it with like engineered hardwood, and seriously, I wouldn't mind having that as like a vacation home. But it's an interesting business model. Why did you choose to invest in this product?
At the time when I was looking, the first thing I was trying to identify which path I wanted to go. And I knew that everybody was in apartment investing, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's a good asset class and has been historically. For years, I had been looking at mobile home parks, listening to podcasts on them. Even as early as, 2016, 2017, we went and tried to buy a couple. Those offers didn't get taken, but I got, for whatever reason, I fell in love with it as an investment, and I've just stuck with it. And now the longer I've been in this industry now, the more that I see I'm happy with what I had picked. Now, again, it's not to say that the other asset classes aren't great. I mentioned earlier, I've got commercial triple net leases here in Austin. I love those. They're low maintenance. Tenants take care of, they run their business, they take care of your property. So there's a lot of ways to do it. But when it comes to the scale that you can get from it, specifically if you have a property that's 50, 60, 70 units and you raise rents by $50, that can be a significant boost to the value and the equity that you've now have built in into that property. So with like commercial real estate, leases are structured and you've got a triple net lease, tenant takes care of everything, but at least everyone knows what they're going to be making over those next handful of years. I like the upside of the mobile home parks. It's something like $60,000 to $80,000 of equity that you can add to your park by infilling an empty lot. So let's say there's an opportunity to go into a park and there are 10 open homes, or sorry, let's say plots that don't have a house, or even they're just vacant and they're not collecting rent. The act of you filling that up and charging lot rent for that in itself can increase your property value by 60 to 80 thousand dollars for each unit. So over 10 units, let's say you fill that, now you've increased the value of your property by $600,000 at minimum. And that's pretty cool. So that's why I like it as well. There's a lot of upside. And, you know, with land, sometimes you can expand, but a lot of them are just protected because they're grandfathered in. You couldn't tear it all down and or go next door and do the exact same thing anymore.
Are new developments like that still being developed?
I've seen a couple locally, and I have seen some around, like sometimes for workforce. Think, you know, in Texas, we've got the Midland, Odessa area. There's a lot of oil and gas and workers that are out there. You'll see them be thrown up on plots of land. But generally speaking, you know, there are people that focus on the development side of it. You'll know more about this than I, but there is a probably setting up what you know today as a traditional mobile home park. You're not going to see those to the same degree in what they were allowed to be built back in the day. So in fact, I don't know how many, it's a very limited number of proper mobile home parks that have been established. Now you will see new RV parks and whatnot that are being built up. And some of those have I've seen like a blended approach to where they'll have some long-term stays and some short-term, you know, transient turnover traffic. But again, they're very protected. I'm hoping that for the sake of the affordable housing crisis, I hope that they loosen restrictions. It would be nice to see more and more families be able to get into them. A, because it's something that people can afford, but also that you mentioned on your factory tour, they can be very nice. So yeah, that would probably mess up the investor game of having, you know, the supply cap taken away. But it would be cool if cities would allow more and more places for people to live, because what Austin's doing specifically is they're trying to make our city more dense and more urban. So they're allowing people to build more units in their backyard or on a particular property now with smaller acreage or smaller lot size. So it's like, if you're going to do that, those can still be expensive. Why not allow new facilities for people to live at, or communities that they can be homeowners, it's affordable, and people generally stay there long term. But again, I think it comes down to taxes is why the cities don't want it. States, yeah.
Yeah, of course, they need to figure out how to make money on this. And I mean, it's interesting. I see various different proposals. Of course, we're in Seattle, so, you know, they're trying to tax their way through all kinds of challenges. And I haven't seen good results out of it. But I recently saw a proposal, I think it was City of Seattle, that was trying to propose to increase taxes on building permits. And so, you know, I'm thinking, hey, if they can't, like in case of mobile home parks, if they can't make money on property taxes, maybe they can make money on building permits.
Get it somewhere else.
Get it somewhere, right?
Yeah. Seattle was also, y'all were early adopters of putting multiple units and allowing multiple ADUs on the property. From what I recall, I know there's a couple people in your city that do that on a large scale. The whole idea of forcing value onto your property. And
yeah, it's so they passed a state law a couple of years ago that requires every municipality to adopt it. I think their deadline to adopt it was end of 2025. So I think by the end of this year, every municipality in the state must adopt the new state requirement to allow two ADUs. But what I've noticed is some really affluent, high-end, you know, expensive neighborhoods, they obviously don't want people to be building little ADUs and then renting them out and having this mix of tenants. They are becoming creative. They are creating various restrictions on connecting utilities to those new developments. You know, if you decided to put an ADU in a very nice, expensive neighborhood, they might say, you know, you have to pay $500,000 in connection fees to hook up a sewer to that little
because that approach, bad for neighbors, right? You don't want to have those next to your house, especially in an affluent neighborhood. But
exactly,
lots of opportunity for investors that have an investor friendly government, local government, that allows them to do those sorts of things.
No, for sure. I mean, even in my neighborhood, what I've started seeing is single family homes, infill homes are being rebuilt. This neighborhood has developed like in the 50s, and a lot of older homes are being torn down and replaced with new houses. But they are getting pretty expensive now. They became north of $3 million for a new construction home.
Wow. Yeah.
And it's becoming less and less affordable. So with this new ADU law, I started seeing duplexes. So they tear down an old house, build a duplex. They call left side a main house, right side an ADU, even though they're two identical units. And so they sort of circumvented that, or not circumvented, I guess. They used the law to their advantage to make the homes a little bit smaller and try to build two homes on a single family lot.
Yeah, nothing wrong with that. So, but I know.
No,
if you're the neighbor, you might not like it. I get it. Brings more cars and traffic to the neighborhood.
Yeah, I mean, people are generally rejecting change. So whatever neighborhood is changing, a lot of people that grew up there, that lived there for the last 20, 30 years, they get angry. The photograph that posted on social media, I photographed a sign in front of one of the older homes that says, "Stop selling your land to developers, save our neighborhood."
Yeah.
I'm like, I mean, it's going to change. Like, these homes are old. They're going to have to change. My response to that was, that's right. Don't sell it to developers. Develop it yourself.
Develop it yourself. Yeah. My name's Eugene. Here's my card. Yeah. Yeah, I'd agree with you. It change is inevitable, and a lot of people will restrict it or resist it is the word. Resist it, but it's how the world works.
Exactly.
People just have, to your point, go do it yourself. You don't like it, either go do it yourself, or unfortunately, you hate seeing that. There's a lot of talk about that in Austin as well with gentrification and people building. It is, you know, while on one hand you think, okay, these families and communities have been here for 60 years and now they're being displaced by high cost. But my argument against that is that if they have an opportunity to sell their property to a developer and make a lot more money than they ever would have had, you know, why not do that? It's the same reasoning if somebody's complaining about, I have family that lives in San Diego, constantly complaining about how expensive it is, how it's not affordable to live there. I'm like, move, go somewhere else. You know, you work remote, and the world allows us to be free, and it's a capitalistic society. So do as you wish and put yourself in the position to prosper and play the game. Come play the real estate game.
Exactly. Come play the real estate game. I think that's the perfect conclusion to our conversation. Ian, thank you so much for joining me here at Real Estate Development Land to Legacy. I learned a lot myself, and hopefully it was useful to the audience. Thanks again, Ian.
Yeah, thank you so much. Real estate development. Land to Legacy.